This is News from the Peak. I'm Joe Mamlin. Well, welcome back to a brand new season of News from the Peak. And we're so excited to be able to kick off the season with a great guest, Taylor Haygood. Taylor's an author, educator, artist, and much more. Comes to us by way of David Ram. So I've asked David to tell us a little bit more about Taylor, his background, and what we're going to talk about today.
So Taylor is primarily a professor at literature at Florida Atlantic University, where he's had a very distinguished career as a scholar, primarily of William Faulkner, but other writers as well, and is a very highly regarded teacher and a lecturer of, you know, no small renown in kind of a 19th century sort of lecture circuity way where you feel like he can talk about anything and everyone will want to listen, as I think you'll agree as you hear this podcast. Taylor's most recent book is called String Bean, The Life and Murder of a Country Music Legend. It's doing really well, and it's just a completely fascinating book. I really recommend reading it. I think anyone who does will find it both gripping in a kind of page-turning way, but also a really fascinating history of the formation of country music, as at least as I know it today. And even, you know, a little bit of a history of the South for a certain part of the period as well.
One of the most challenging things going through this episode is we had such a great time talking to him, and there was so much that I didn't have time to put in the episode, and we just really hope he'll come back again, because he certainly is a fascinating person and has a lot to say.
It's going to be a great show, and welcome to season 3, and we'll be right back.
Well, it's very nice to meet everybody. Nice to meet Joe, Robert, nice to meet you again, David.
Nice to meet you too, Taylor.
Well, reading String Bean kind of brought into focus that whole generation of folks that came along in the 20s and 30s and became the greatest generation. And just the way they viewed life. I mean, we talked about it earlier about String Bean not trusting banks. And
right. You know,
I can remember talking to my grandmother, and she'd say, or I'd say, "How are things going?" And she'd say, "They're going good, darling, but they won't last. That hard coming again." And it was just that whole way of thinking about that, you know, nothing good's going to last. We're going to be in a depression again, and everybody's going to be starving. And then just the whole attitude, you know, we're losing. I mean, there's probably less than, you know, 100,000 men left that fought in World War II.
Oh, yeah. I can't imagine there would be many at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that about your grandmother. And, you know, I mentioned my grandmother in the beginning of the book. This is my dad's mother. My mom's mother grew up in North Mississippi, and she was in Memphis. She went to Hume High School in Memphis. To her dying day, if she met somebody new, she would say, "I went to Hume High School," by which she meant she went to the same high school Elvis went to. But she didn't happen to mention that she was there about 2 or 3 decades before that. She didn't mention that part of it. But, you know, she was not really so much a country music fan. But she had also, you know, she had grown up. She'd been born in 1918. So she had she really had enough memory of the 1920s really to feel that contrast. But, you know, it's North Mississippi. She didn't really come from, you know, a lot of money or anything. So I think, you know, it was kind of a different experience for her. But my dad's mother, whom I mentioned in the book, whose name was Asley, Virginia Asley Jackson, and she grew up in this little town called Minor Hill, Tennessee, right on the Tennessee-Alabama border. And you know, she felt that her dad did have a lot of money. He had a lot of land in North Alabama. They had land actually in Florida. And in fact, my grandparents got married in Florida just right before my grandfather went to Europe. You know, he was in the Army Corps of Engineers. And I don't want to bore you with this, but I guess just to your point, I know that thing. I think my grandmother and her family were given to that particular grandmother too, a kind of a cynical, doubtful view of the world anyway. But there was a similar way of talking, you know, this idea that things are about to go down, things are about to go bad. And that was a pretty important, you know, thing. And they had a lot of, she had a big family. A lot of people died very young. But, you know, they loved country music and they, now she didn't not trust banks, but they were always, there was something always very edgy about them. And I wanted to get that. I think to me, the important thing to have her in the book was to try to capture how people responded to String Bean. Because I'll tell you one of the most fascinating, I'll tell you this, Robert, I don't know if you're a nice, meeting you, I can tell you're a nice gentleman. So you probably didn't ever watch Hee Haw and stuff like that, you know, but Hee Haw kind of shaped my view of a lot of things. Probably shouldn't
have said that. Dr. Haygood, I was just telling them, I'm sorry, guys.
You go ahead.
My Saturday afternoons were Farrell and Husky and...
okay. And,
We all watched Hee Haw. All of us watched Hee Haw.
I mean, and they all had that genre of, you know, they had a Pretty Blonde on there, Porter Wagon, Alan Pardon, but they'd, you know, do the music, and they'd have their comedian come out who was somebody like String Bean.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Welburn Brothers. There was a, you mentioned him in the book.
Archie Campbell was a big one. And,
but then they'd have that religious song at the end, so.
Yeah, right. That's true. Well, I didn't want to drag you into this, Robert, but since we're there, since you got yourself there, then we're all on the same page on that.
Yes, sir. So, and it was hillbilly music. It wasn't country music.
No, that's true. Yeah, at the time, especially in the 30s and 40s and even the 50s, it was hillbilly music. It wasn't that idea of country. That's a more fairly more recent idea.
So how did you come to write about String Bean? You've written literary critical books. You're a scholar, William Faulkner, Harlem Renaissance writers, lots of publications along those lines, Walt Whitman, others. And then, boom, String Bean.
Yeah.
What brought you there, if I may?
Yeah, you know, that's in a way, it's a kind of hard question to answer. I mean, why do any of us do anything, I guess? But as far as the specifics of this, I did grow up. I always loved old country music when I was a kid, and partly because of my dad's mother. And I liked all kind of music, but I really loved the old country, by which I mean Jimmy Rogers, who was... there were two Jimmy Rogers, but the original one, the one from Mississippi, and that's where I was born. And I kind of like, I thought there was something really neat about that yodeling. And I always liked Hank Williams and Patsy Cline and those people. And I remember being a kid, and I had gotten there was an old book that it had a red cover, and it was like a history of country music. And I was excited about reading about Jimmy Rogers and those people. But as I was going through looking at the Grand Ole Opry, I saw a picture of String Bean. And I thought, boy, that guy's got a weird anatomy, you know, his long torso and little short legs. And I couldn't figure that out. He had a kind of a weird look on his face. Anyway, around that time, my dad played the guitar a lot. He played a lot of folk music. He was in Nashville, and he and my mom met there and would go to Centennial Park. And that, I don't know if y'all know I don't know if Robert, you ever made it up to Nashville at all, but it's there's a big Centennial Park at that time in the late 60s was kind of a hippie hangout, and they would play a lot of Joan Baez and Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul and Mary songs, people like that. And my dad played a kind of a, he had a Fender guitar, acoustic guitar, and he would play. And but we met a fellow, had a family friend who had a big old, big body Gibson with F-holes in it, kind of like Maybelle Carter played guitar, big loud guitar. And he played in the country style. And I remember at one time he and my dad had him over, and another guy who was from the Ozark Mountains and was visiting in the area. And he was playing the harmonica, and they played this country music, and it was like, it just rattled the house. You know, it was like nothing I'd ever, it was very different from the kind of soft, softer kind of, you know, I don't know, again, Peter, Paul, and Mary kind of thing. And anyway, so I got interested in music. I loved, and I started kind of learning to play the guitar and the harmonica, and I was interested in blues music. In fact, this harmonica player gave me an old blues harp, Hohner blues harp, and a tape of Sonny Boy Williamson. And he said, don't let your mama hear this. But anyway, so that was how I started playing the harmonica. But I got, what I really loved was watching Hee Haw and watching Roy Clark on Pickin' and Grinning. They play Cripple Creek, and I'd watch that banjo, and I thought, man, there's something about that thing. There's just something about that instrument. And it just kind of got to me, and I pestered my mom and dad. They finally bought me a Harmony 5-string banjo from Sears catalog. And it was supposed to be for my birthday. It didn't come in for a month, and it was the longest month of my life. But anyway, we finally got it in, and I was just, I didn't know how to tune the thing, but it was something about the sound of it. And I kind of kept pestering them, and we finally went to the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I saw String Beans Banjo had a Vega number 9 Vibraphone banjo. I didn't know that at the time, but I looked at all those inlays, and, you know, this the head of it, the white head of it had been worn away because he played what he called a rapping style, but it's basically a clawhammer style. And it, and I thought, man, this thing, and I'd always been moved by older things that were worn. My dad's brother died very young. He was 24 years old, but my dad had his old baseball glove and catcher's mitt, and it was so worn. And I was always fascinated by things that were worn. I had a sort of touch and tinge of tragedy about them, I think. And in fact, I heard my mom and dad at the time talking. They said, well, this guy kind of made a connection because they said, well, this gentleman who had this banjo had been murdered. And so that stuck with me. And then I kind of grew up and I guess, and started writing scholarship on Faulkner and that kind of thing. And became a professor, and I started doing that lecturing I was talking about. And as part of that, I did I was an MC for a charity event for a few years with a certain group, and they a place called Ballin Isles in Florida, and they had a bunch of writers in. They had people like Scott Ellsworth, who's a big help to me, and Tom Clavin, and Lawrence Lemer lives in Palm Beach, and a lot of people who were writing kind of nonfiction or biography. And I was kind of looking for something, and I had gotten promoted about that time to full professor. I was looking for a story anyway to tell. And then up on my phone one day pops a video of String Bean. And I thought, man, I'd love to read a book about him. And there wasn't one. There was a book that had been written about the murder and the investigation that was privately published in 1975. But there wasn't anything written in the style of our moment that really told the life story. And I thought, okay, well, let me see about whether or not I can pursue writing this. And that's how it happened. The story is probably, that's the longest version I've told anybody in public about it. There's probably a longer version than that, you know what I mean? But bless your heart. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate y'all listening. I hope whoever's listening in, I hope that wasn't too long a story.
So could you give us some sense of who String Bean was and kind of his importance in the development of country music as it is now?
Absolutely. He was a gentleman who was originally from the eastern part of Kentucky, Jackson County. And I grew up there and, pardon me, started playing banjo and all of that when he was a kid. And there were a lot of banjo players from that part of the world. And he competed in a contest that was held by a radio station in Lexington, which is not too terribly far away. And he didn't win the contest, but he did manage to get a spot on the radio station, one of the radio stations there. And working with somebody who had been a pretty important talent scout, probably more, Asa Martin was his name, probably more important as a talent scout than as a musician himself. But anyway, he went on, he was the one who actually gave String Bean this name. String Bean's real name was David Aikman. And basically, Asa Martin famously could not remember people's names. And he looked over and saw this tall guy, and he couldn't think of the name. And he said, you know, come on over here, String Bean, and play a song. Some people say he said String Beans, plural, some singular. But anyway, it was the singular version that stuck, and that kind of makes sense, really. But anyway, from that point, he went on to play a number of local bands, and then he was on the radio. And, of course, it's an important time in the radios. We're talking late 1930s at this point. In fact, really, recording radio for country music was more important than recording at that point. They used the radio shows as a way to set up appearances, and that's where they made money. And here in the Depression, they could actually make pretty decent money doing that. So that was kind of the modus, you know, operandi, I guess. But anyway, he did that. Pardon me, managed to get on to a pretty important band, Charlie Monroe, the brother of Bill Monroe, who's understood to be the founder of bluegrass music. A lot of people are going to know that name. Bill Monroe may not know that he originally performed with his brother Charlie in Chicago, WLS. There was a barn dance show there. And anyway, toured with for a little while, about a year, maybe something like that, with Charlie Monroe, did String Bean, David String Bean Aikman. And then he went back to Kentucky for a little while, and then he was with Bill Monroe. And that was really... his being with Bill Monroe was very significant because he was the first banjo player to play with Bill Monroe. And Bill Monroe is the one who starts bluegrass. And there's a very famous recording session there in Chicago, you know, and in the early 1940s. And that's when String Bean, you really start to hear the banjo showing up. Well, String Bean ends up leaving Bill Monroe, and his replacement is none other than Earl Scruggs, who is the banjo player, you know. Is there, everybody's going to know that name, you know. So what a lot of people think about, and there were some reasons why this happened, a lot of people say, well, that's where bluegrass starts with Earl Scruggs, but it's actually String Bean who's playing the banjo first. They're playing two very different styles, although Lester Flatt would later kind of give String Bean some flack. He'd say, well, you know, String Bean was just playing drop thumb or claw hammer style. In fact, he did a two-finger picking style. So it's not quite as rolling. It's not quite as mellifluous as Scruggs' style, but it is a style that was a picking style. But anyway, from that point, he goes into, String Bean's part of the Grand Ole Opry at that point. He's on the very famous Prince Albert segment, and he performs over the course of the next, you know, three decades. He's there. On the night that Hank Williams debuts, String Bean is on the stage. He plays maybe two slots after that. He was right there with all the big comics. Minnie Pearl, Rod Brasfield, Archie Campbell later on, all the big figures of country music. And then he ends up becoming a founding member, a charter member of Hee Haw. And really, by the time he dies, right as the outlaw country movement is starting, one of his neighbors is Willie Nelson of Ridgetop, Tennessee. And Willie Nelson, his house had burned down. He ran in just in time to save some, you know, marijuana so he could kind of like save that at least. Then he left to Nashville altogether and he headed down to Texas. And this has really started, he and Waylon Jennings. And then Hank Williams Jr. comes into play with this, with the outlaw movement. String Bean and his wife Estelle had taken Hank Williams Jr. a little bit under wing after his dad had died. And so you have this kind of situation where String Bean is really a bridge from really the early stages of country music to the outlaw moment. Still significant. You know, he's not in the Country Music Hall of Fame, which is just weird because he really is a big deal. And I'll tell you this, people in Nashville, they all know who String Bean is. And it's very interesting. I don't claim to be at the very center of the country music industry, but writing this book has put me in contact with a lot of people. The late Loretta Lynn, this is one of the final projects she endorsed in her life. Whisperin' Bill Anderson, all kinds of people, you know, and it's String Bean is very much alive. You know, I don't, you know, that legacy, who he was, the idea that he was a decent person, that's very important in his legacy. So that's, I guess, a short version. Of course, he was murdered then in 1973, November the 10th. And that was devastating to the city of Nashville and to the country music industry.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's most interesting about the book is the kind of widespread emphasis on David Eichmann as like a distinctly good guy and beloved. And you see it, just a tiny bit of the footage, and you quote from it too in places, you know, how much when people would introduce him, they would really emphasize that the goodness of String Bean, one of my favorite people, this is a really good guy, you know. It's a very different character. You can hear them hitting those very sincere notes, and I think that comes across really strongly.
Well, if I might just say one thing about that, I think one of the things that in writing a biography that I, and this was my first one, I'm working on the second one now, but what I learned, one of the things I learned about it was, well, for one thing, you formed this connection to the subject, and it's a very mysterious thing, and it'll cause you, or at least me, to wake up in the middle of the night and think, now, how did I get here? You know, and, you know, you kind of wonder how you're connected to this person or if that's real or not. And, you know, not to get too mystical about it, but I think part of it, too, is you feel the weight of ethics about it. You know, like maybe especially with String Bean, maybe with somebody who's more of a stinker, you don't think about it. But with String Bean, you know, we all been alive enough to know that nobody's in a good mood all the time, you know, and nobody's nice all the time. And I think, you know, that's part of developing a character or just writing about a real person is there's going to be the bad stuff, you know, the ugly stuff, the times when they're selfish or they're, or whatever. It's very hard to get to that with String Bean. Now, there are some moments, his military record has some moments that could be viewed in not as good a light, you know, and with String Bean, what I found myself kind of in the feeling this ethical bind, you know, I thought, oh, maybe I shouldn't mention this or that. But, you know, you want to try to give as real a view as you can. But, you know, I don't, he had to argue with his wife, you know, Estelle. He had a first wife a lot of people actually didn't know about. And clearly there was conflict there. He was on the road a lot. She didn't really like that. And so that didn't work out. But you don't really get that. You just don't get, he doesn't seem to have made any enemies. So it was very, what I found was that really I found myself writing about this persona, you know, and really trying to understand what was the connection between the persona and the real person. But what I found was that to whatever degree and on a fairly consistent level, he was able to subsume kind of himself. He was able to sort of channel himself into that persona in a very powerful way. You know, he and his wife and Grandpa and Ramona Jones lived, I mean, like 15 feet from each other. And it seemed to go okay. And I've been in the house. Listen, this house, he probably had to bend over to get underneath the eave of the roof. It's a tiny little house, two-room house, basically. And there's something very aloof about him and very enigmatic. And, you know, my hope is that maybe people will be interested enough in String Bean that, you know, maybe other stories will come out and there'll be other things brought to light. But that was one of the biggest challenges about writing the biography part, because he was not somebody who left behind. You know, this isn't like Chernow writing about George Washington, where George Washington's got two or three adjutants following him around with a trunk full of his papers. And he's very aware of himself as being in a historical moment. And so he has this huge archive for you to deal with, you know. And that's probably, to me, one of the brilliant things about that Chernow biography is all those little things about all those economic arrangements, you know, and that kind of thing. Well, you don't get that with String Bean. You know, I've held in my hand one letter, one of the letters from home String Bean wrote. Now, by the way, there's a common myth out there that String Bean couldn't read and write, but reality is he could. He could sign his name, he could write, and he could read, and, you know, he could do that. But that's a fact about writing this story. Not only did you have the two different stories and how to put those together was so challenging, the biography and the sort of the crime part of it, but the biography itself, for me, it was very challenging because it was so hard to get to the person. You have all these stories. And so what you did have to do is go around and say, okay, here's how Porter Wagoner reacted, or here's how Loretta Lynn reacted.
Well, I think what you did very well in the book was that he recognized that people were coming to see String Bean. They weren't coming to see David
Yes.
play the banjo. And I think he was, toward the end, he was more String Bean than he was David Aikman. And a lot of people just picked up on that persona. He was smart enough to have that persona. And that persona was kind of a dumb guy that had a letter next to his heart. Deal. And
yes.
And the smart David Aikman that built all of that was kind of in the background somewhere.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. And I think I completely believe that's the truth of the matter. I do.
I think one thing that also touches on it is I hadn't realized kind of going into it how much String Bean was a musician, but very much a comedian, and that those were kind of fused roles in a way that's not where things like country in the most mainstream sense have really gone, and that just in general, that sort of full entertainer kind of mode. And I think I think that in itself is interesting, and I'd like to hear more about it, but I think it's also one of my favorite parts of the first part of the book is the contrast that you draw between David Aikman, String Bean, and Pete Seeger as banjo players. It made me think a lot about kind of what counts as authenticity, and especially for something like folk music, where, you know, you've got this Manhattan born, I believe, and raised guy playing folk music, and Pete Seeger, you know, doing great stuff. No, you'll hear no bad words about Pete Seeger from me, but comparing that with, you know, somebody like String Bean, who I kind of had to fight for a certain level of respectability. I mean, he was getting paid or whatever, that's fine, but that respectability was very different. And I think a lot of it was probably along the lines of authenticity. But I did really like that part. And I think it's really telling about kind of how history tries to get written in the moment. And that if they'd stopped the needle at 1960 and said, write the history of the banjo in America, you've got a huge section about Pete Seeger, and maybe you do now, and probably not much of anything about String Bean. And I think part of that is connected to that kind of overall entertainer mode, this idea that you kind of can't be both things or all things.
That was something, I guess, for me, because I had come from a background of loving old country music, but also having this strong folk presence in my life through my parents. And I love that. I love the music. I do. Love Pete Seeger. I love Peter Paul and Mary, some of my favorite music. I love all those people, you know. I think all my life I have that's been that contrast. It has been very striking to me how similar and yet just so far apart those two different kinds of music are. It's sort of at work even with Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family. You know, they're doing the same thing in a lot of ways, and yet the Carter family feels more folky and Jimmy Rogers is more commercial. And you think, well, is it just that simple, you know? Is it just that in terms of authenticity? Is it just that simple? If you go by that reckoning, in a way, String Bean ought to seem less authentic than Pete Seeger, you know? And yet, I think you can make the argument in the opposite way, in a way that you were gesturing to, that for Pete Seeger, it's a learned thing. He's almost like Hemingway going to Austria or somewhere, you know. He's everything is heightened so he can see, in a way, as an outsider. He can see things that insiders cannot see in the same way. And he was working with the, you know, different sort of group of people in North Carolina and so forth. Well, meanwhile, you know, you have a Faulkner or somebody who's inside it, you know, and you know, as far as writers are concerned, but in the case of String Bean, yes, he's inside in a way, and things that he almost cannot speak about, or it compromises the authenticity. He almost can't be aware of it, or it compromises that. And so one wonders how much he even is or isn't actually aware of anything, or what he, and then how that compares to what he can or cannot say. But I think to me, it's a bigger sort of question or issue about what roots music actually means. You know, what does roots music sort of mean for the country? Now, you know, there's another book out right now, as you all may know, about Robert Johnson. And the writer of the book had is dead now, but had been writing about Robert Johnson. It was the first person to bring, this is the blues singer Robert Johnson from Mississippi. He was the first person to bring Robert Johnson information to life, you know, into the public, and really go in there and do the research. He was from Pittsburgh, the writer. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he went to the Delta in Mississippi, and he's studying everything about out, and he says, this is Robert Johnson, blah, blah, blah. David, you may remember, David and I went to graduate school many, many thousands of years ago, and we were teaching a class, and we had a textbook. We were teaching first year writing, I think, I don't know what was, I guess if we call it that now. And that was one of the student essays was all about whether or not Robert Johnson actually did sell his soul to the devil at the crossroads. I don't know if you remember that. That was that was one of the essays. But, you know, that this guy, though, had written all this work. Then, in the middle of his life, he was writing this biography. In the middle of his life, he does an about-face and says, the Robert Johnson I discovered is not the real Robert Johnson. And then he goes and makes a whole case for a totally different guy being Robert Johnson, the Robert Johnson, only for everybody to find out that he actually would lift entire passages from Hemingway and so forth. He would do all these diversions. He would put actual information he knew to be not factual in so he could catch anybody. He had like this sort of theory that people were out to get him. I don't know if that included the FBI or not, but you know, he had this whole thing and this whole elaborate thing. He never got the book published, but he passed away and now it's been released posthumously. Why am I talking about all that? Is because it's all to me about the issue of roots music and authenticity. You know, who is it? How is it? Why is it? How do you get to be a roots music player? Do you compromise yourself if you've grown up in rural, you know, Georgia and you've played the music all your life and you're doing this thing, but maybe you dress up a certain way because people want to see you do this thing. Does that make it that way? You know, you're talking about country music in our moment. And one of the things about country music is it has this built-in crisis, okay? Because unlike popular music, which is always looking forward, like it's always you're trying to get to the next thing. So you get somebody like Frank Sinatra who gets to be in his 50s and 60s, and he's over here putting on a Nehru coat, trying to look mod. But somebody like, but the country music is a different problem because it's built in backward looking, you know, it's built in to be traditional. But it has to remain relevant. So, in other words, what's traditional, if you listen to Uncle Dave Macon now, it may, for a lot of people, it's going to be unintelligible. It's just nothing about it. The sound, the words, the lyrics, nothing is intelligible to a lot of people. There are people who continue this. One of them is my friend, Leroy Troy, kind of keeps all those traditions alive. But for a lot of if you're going to make money, and this is about that, it's hard to do it. So you have to kind of keep creating a moving the line of what is traditional. So like when I was a kid, you know, 1970s outlaw music is pretty edgy still. Yeah. Now it's kind of more traditional. That's what you're going to hear on Sirius XM Willie's Roadhouse, you know? So yeah. You have to keep, so basically what happens with country music is about every decade. I don't want to sound too much like, you know, Clemenza, but about every 10 years, you're going to have a war because country music has to figure out how to make itself relevant while still maintaining this traditional thing. So right now you see it happening. There's this kind of probing like, okay, where do you go in terms of, we'll say racial diversity or something like that, or gender, and sort of like, what is it? What's the sound going to be? And how do you kind of figure out what this is going to be in our moment? It's happened over and over again. It happened in String Bean's own time. He, you know, what's fascinating about him is how he managed to stay relevant over all those decades. But all of this has to do with authenticity. It was an issue when I was a kid. I remember the 1980s, I knew people who just hated the idea that there were drums in country music. And they said, this country music is just 50s rock warmed over. You know, now somebody look at the 1980s and say, well, that's a hardcore country, you know? So it kind of depends. I think it's fascinating in terms of kind of what is this larger issue not just about music, but about roots culture and authentic culture in general. I think it's a, I don't know, that's a very pedantic answer. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I think it's hard to discuss, like you were talking about, getting back to the roots of country music. It's hard to discuss String Bean or any performer without talking about some of them had very unpleasant sides to them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, String Bean performed in blackface, you know. And now he, you know, there's some interesting work, I think, to be that has been done where people are thinking about kind of how this sort of country comic figure, kind of hillbilly figure in country music kind of ended up being a kind of a reworking of some of the minstrel traditions, you know. And there's some very interesting nuanced work that's been done. You know, one of the people I talked to, Dom Flemons, really fascinating person, great musician, tremendous scholar. He was involved, I think he may have put together a group called the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and he had really gone back. You know, I think his album Black Cowboys, I think it goes back, and he goes back to those old Lomax recordings, and he says, okay, now where did they come from? And he is a really fascinating person. The other people, Renan Giddens, and sort of holder of a MacArthur Fellowship right now, or maybe it's run out now, but you know, they have been really doing, really kind of revisiting those traditions and acknowledge, while at the same time acknowledging all of the cultural pain built into those, are also saying, okay, what is there to study? And they do some very, very interesting work. So, you know, but yeah, they're there. Those other sides are there in terms of perform of those particular modes of performativity. Yeah, absolutely.
But one thing you talked about earlier on in writing this book, and you know, it's so well researched and there's so much here, but you said this was, it wasn't like writing about a normal historical figure where there was that amount of material to draw from. So how did, talk a little bit about how you persevered through this. Like, were there moments where you thought it was impossible, and what made you fight through that? How did you, what was inside you that made you want to just do whatever it took and get this down on paper?
Well, I really appreciate that question very much. And it's, These are questions that get that really at the heart of my experience with this thing. And it was a long road. The actual writing and researching started probably around 2017. People have done longer roads, certainly in a book, and I'm well aware of that. But for me, it meant, for one thing, having to learn an entirely new array of research methods. As a literary critic, I had done a little few interviews here and there, you know, but I really had to kind of start trying to figure out how do you get in touch with Loretta Lynn? How do you do that, you know? And that was a little bit harder than I expected, you know? I mean, like, how do you do that? You know, I guess I expected that to be hard, but, you know, how do you do that? Then what do you say? You know, get on the phone with Ronnie Stoneman or Lulu Roman. What do you say to them? How do you kind of address what you hope to get addressed without leading somebody on or shaping the question? Those are big questions, you know, that I really had to deal with in the moment, in the real time. Then there was all the other people you talk to, the people who are the cousins of the nephews of String Bean's first wife, you know, the people who, you know, they may not be literary or literate even in some cases, but, you know, or they may be very much so, but they may have some kind of knowledge about this or that, who knows? Anyway, you know, that kind of thing. I ended up, because there's really not a lot of archival material on String Bean, I did work at the Country Music Hall of Fame. And by the way, they were great to work with, but they just have a little tiny folder on String Bean, you know, there's just not that much. There's information here and there, but I ended up really kind of having to kind of build my own archive of String Bean things, his joke book, his all of his records, that kind of thing. Going through, I probably read 3,000 pages of court records in Nashville, Tennessee, you know, from the transcripts from the trial, and you know, I talked to Tommy Jacobs, one of the investigators. By the way, there aren't many people still alive from all of that, everything that happened in 1973 and 74. But I really appreciate the way you put this. I don't want to get lost in all those details, but because I particularly appreciate the way you asked that question in terms of was saying, how did you persevere? Because in 2017, in my mind, I thought, well, this is going to be a quick project. You know, I'm going to tell the story of the life. I won't have to go into too much detail necessarily. You know, hopefully make it interesting, talk about him, talk about the death and the murder and so forth. And that was kind of how I saw it. Then, you know, that it kind of changed once I began to realize. I think one of the things that began to hit me is how much String Bean and his wife Estelle vanished from the story when you get to the murder investigation and trial. You can almost forget all about them. And yet you've got to have them in your minds in order for that all to make really make sense. And so I thought, well, how in the world am I going to do this? And then as I started digging deeper into his life and seeing things and seeing kind of the drama in his life, some, you know, it's not Johnny Cash level drama by any means, but it is drama in the sense that there were certain internal things happening, you know, in the field. Well, anyway, long story short, I had written this thing up pretty much, and I started approaching agents, and then all of a sudden, boom, here comes the pandemic, you know, the shutdown comes. I'm getting emails from agents saying, listen, we like this project, but we can't really take anybody new on right now, you know. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? You know, what do I do? And I had, from the beginning of this project, and I already knew about it, University of Illinois Press, and they had this great, you know, series, Music in American Life, and I knew it was a situation where I could approach the press directly. And they were super excited about it, very thrilled. Laurie Matheson, great director of that press, and she got back immediately, and, you know, but then started going through that process, you know, of the reader reports. And, you know, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of their biographies are written by country music journalists, you know, and I'm coming at it not from that viewpoint. I don't live in Nashville. I'm coming at it from more of a literary viewpoint, you know, and so my way of thinking about writing didn't always quite match up with theirs. Then it was only then really that I started actually doing even really getting even deeper into String Bean's life. It was really during the pandemic where a lot of the interviews, more of the big interviews that I had had, I did. Also, at that point, I realized at that point more than ever just how important it was for me to understand the banjo as an instrument. I came to understand that the banjo is a character in this thing. And in fact, one of the last things of the book is the banjo, you know. And when I really realized, and there was a great person at Country Music Hall of Fame, Jack Clutter, I want to say thank you to him for really helping me understand how String Bean's banjo was built. And I realized that banjo, that Vega banjo, is nothing like, I mean, obviously it's still a banjo, but there, the guts of that banjo, the way of thinking about the building of it's very different from the kind of Gibson Mastertone banjos that Earl Scruggs and all these other banjo people did, you know, from ever since then. And that has a certain kind of tone ring. I don't want to get too technical, but it has a certain kind of tone ring. There's a certain depth of the resonator. There are all these things, little things, that make a huge difference in how that banjo works. And I said, well, I'm going to have to learn this. And so as part of that project, I said, okay, I'm going to build my own banjo. I managed to get a resonator. I found one on eBay that was literally made probably the same year by the same company as String Bean's. And I started building up from that because I thought, I've got to understand this. So, and those are the things, those are the moments where it was easier to persevere. And to be really honest with you, there are a lot of moments where I thought, man, I don't know if I can keep this thing going, you know, because it was very hard to put the two stories together. I did it with this kind of what I called an interlude, which was the last day of String Bean's life, which was written in a kind of a narrative style. But I mean, the whole thing is in a narrative style, but this was a more impressionistic kind of narration. But, you know, there were a lot of times I thought, oh, is there even really a story worth telling here? And in the end, I believe it is, because I think that the story of this person's life is important.
Well, there were so many layers to the book. So I don't know if you intended that. I mean, like, you know, is there ever forgiveness for killing a saint? Was toward the end of the book, I think, about the gentleman having a conversion, and was that really a true conversion? And can you be forgiven for killing a saint?
Yes, sir. Well, in fact, I appreciate very much you saying that that has those layers, because I would like to just to address that for just a minute. And one doesn't always know maybe even what's in a book, but who's written it. But I will say this, that it was very important to me to write this book really for people who are not necessarily country music people. I want them to, it was very important to me to try to put String Bean in a context, whether it was with Pete Seeger or Frank Sinatra or whomever, and the world that he was in and how he was navigating that world. You can't put everything in there, but I wanted that. My hope is that this is a book that will appeal to people who may not have any interest in true crime or in country music, because I think it's a story. I think the String Bean story is about all these other things. And yes, the question about, you know, the killer, there's something almost Greek. There's almost a sort of a Greek tragedy dimension to this story. And as far as, you know, String Bean, he's a kind of sacrificial lamb. Is he guilty of a kind of hubris? You know, I mentioned right before the last day of his life, I mentioned this moment where he stands up and he tells the guitar player that he who plays the five-string banjo rules the world. And it's at this moment where he gets to the top, you know, and that's where it comes. And you have a kind of a chorus in a way, because you have the whole Nashville scene and so forth who kind of comment in a way on it. And so there is something very ancient, I think, about this story. And I think the question of, you know, kind of how to deal with the killers, you know, John Brown is the gentleman who was paroled and he was in prison. He and Doug, his cousin Doug, John Brown was paroled in 2014. It's a huge deal in Nashville then. And even now, you know, I've talked to different country music people and say, well, I saw that guy the other day. I saw John Brown putting gas in his car, you know, and you know, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that in real life? You know, you've got this story that has this kind of ancient sort of archetypal quality about it, you know, sacrificial lamb, people who come across at least as kind of pure evil. But then you got this everyday life thing where this thing is still happening. You know, you have people who live, very nice couple and their child who live in String Bean's house. And, you know, they're there every day. And, you know, one of the interesting things about that house, there's a cave right behind the house. And there's a certain kind of, I think it's a beetle that's in that cave. And it's like the only one, this particular type of beetle in the whole world. And so the owner was talking about it. He said, man, you know, it's like you get two different kinds of people who come to the house, the String Bean people and the people who are into, you know, I don't know, biologists. And this is all kind of unfolding, you know, as it is right now. This is all still alive in a way. And but that question, yeah, of, I like the way you put that. Is there redemption for killing a saint? And I think it's very problematic. I guess I won't get into the story of that, but it was very, doing some of the research, trying to speak to John Brown, didn't work out in the end. I tried, but you know, there was a sense of trying to move on, I think. I have a friend named Carl Rollison, who's a biographer, and he's really written a lot about writing biography. And, you know, one of the things he talked about, he said, I love to read the acknowledgments in a biography because you can see in it the story of all the, you know, all the sort of compromises and challenges and so forth that go to a biographer. And sort of how to write about this situation with somebody who has committed this crime, or at least is thought to have committed this crime, and how he deals with that. And there's something very riveting about it. And I wish that it had worked out to have more of that in the book. You know, I wish I could have talked to him, but I wasn't able to pull it off. Maybe I didn't know the right technique, you know, maybe in the future I would know how, but I didn't quite know how to get to it. I did have an interesting thing happen. I was the first book signing I had was in Palm Beach for this thing at the Society of the Four Arts. And there were people there. And there was a gentleman came up afterwards and he said, hey, I'm from Tennessee. And he said, I'd like for you to, he had bought a copy and he said, I'd like for you to make the book out to John Brown. And I thought, oh, wait, who? And he said, oh yeah, no, I worked in the prison system connected with security some way, he said, and said he knew John Brown. I'm sure he'd be glad to talk to you and all this. And I thought, well, okay. You know, so who knows? I mean, I also have this feeling that my life will, you know, you're kind of connected with String Bean from now on. So, you know, what else will happen with that? I really don't know. But I think he has an interesting story. I think Mr. Brown's story is very interesting. He has a very interesting life story also. And kind of the development of him And there were people, you know, it's interesting. There are people who don't buy the John Brown's conversion at all. And then there are other people who do. Lulu Roman was one of the nicest people. It's a big hee-haw person. Y'all probably remember Lulu. And she had probably my favorite lines. You know, she was not a country music fan. She didn't know who any of these people were. She knew Buck Owens. When she got on to hee-haw, she didn't know who these people were. And I asked her, what did you think when you saw this guy, String Bean, in his costume? And she said, honey, I was eating so much LSD at that time that I thought that one of these creatures I was seeing had become real. And I thought, okay, you know, and it was one of the greatest lines. But, you know, she was very compassionate about John Brown. She believed his conversion was complete and real and was very sincere. And, you know, so you have people all over the place, you know, with this thing.
I feel like coming through every page toward the end is the, like, it was all Charlie. So was it all Charlie?
Well, you know, I have to tread very carefully on this one. I didn't put anything there in the book that's not a matter of public record. You know, I guess the way I would address it is to say that not only was I having to learn about biography, but also writing true crime. One of the takeaways from this experience is that murder is always messy. I have a very different, after this experience, this is a very open and shut case in many people's minds, you know, and I certainly don't, I'm not at all suggesting that it's something that should be reopened or anything like that. I'm not suggesting that in any way. I do think that the trial resulted in people being arrested who were absolutely at the scene of the crime and involved in it, and that's absolutely the case. But I will say this, the jurors themselves came out of that experience saying, we don't really know quite what happened, except that those John and Doug Brown were there and they did something bad. There was societal pressure on the investigators to find the murderers. There was a tremendous pressure on them. Now, by the way, I should tell you, there was another big trial that took place very soon after the String Bean trial called the Marsha Trimble trial. This was also in Nashville, featured a lot of the same investigators. And in that case, they got the wrong person. And it was a big deal in Nashville. I don't want to reduce that. We'll say it this way, is my understanding that they didn't maybe find the right person. It was a big deal in Nashville. So I think there was a lot of pressure. I think there's a lot of pressure on investigators, on police to get things like this figured out. I don't envy them. I don't think I would have done any better than they did. I happen to be in the position of a writer and having some distance on it that they didn't have. But, you know, I want to say Mr. Jacobs, for example, was very generous in talking about this. But he himself said, listen, I think Charlie Brown was the ringleader of this thing. And, you know, he himself will tell you that. I certainly don't want to make life difficult for him, you know, but I think that murder is very messy. And, you know, the whole story of this thing, I think, may never be known. My original, the way the book opens is with Grandpa Jones finding the bodies. But that was not how I originally wanted to write it. I wanted to write it with this taut scene of the night of the murder. And, you know, John and Doug go to the house and String Bean comes back. And I wanted to narrate the murder. But the more I learned about the whole thing, the more I realized you can't do that. What actually happened that night is not really known. Now, people say Doug Brown made a confession. In fact, if you go and look at the Nashville Banner article, and I thought about putting that in as an appendix, by the way, but I decided against it in the end. But if you go look at that Nashville Banner article, it's written in third person by Larry Brenton, who was the same guy who later on, and no offense to anybody who's listening and connected with Larry Brenton, but the fact is he says himself that he went and basically held evidence, you know, away, kind of like police evidence, and, you know, held it kind of away from the public and so forth in a way that is very questionable ethically, we'll say. But anyway, you know, he wrote this article in third person quoting Doug Brown in a way that is a somewhat novelistic style, and in a way that was designed to put the blame on John Brown and was done for the purpose by Joe Binkley, who was this guy who, you know, who basically was the highest paid lawyer in Nashville, and he represented these Belle Meade widows. It was a very nice part of town. And the deal was that he, you know, he was over here getting paid all this money. He put Doug Brown's confession, he had done this in other cases, he put the confession in the paper so that he could have a way to get the his client's voice into the trial without that person taking the stand. But a third person article in a newspaper is basically hearsay, you know? I mean, it's especially when it's obviously designed to put the blame on somebody else. So, you know, people say, well, that's the true story of what happened. No, it isn't. The reality, I mean, it could be, but it's not necessarily the case that that story sort of ends the conversation. It's John Brown had a very different version of how he thought. He was talking about having passed out through the whole thing. He didn't even remember it. And the fact is, he was on record of having passed out in other cases. So, you know, the question about that, I don't know. And of course, yes, you have these names, John Brown, like John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave from the old song, and then Charlie Brown. And, you know, it made it very hard to research these people, by the way, because there's a lot of names like that, you know. So that was another thing. It was hard to tell their stories. You know, it was very hard to go out and find much about them because there's not much out there if you go online. So, it's a messy business. And I hope it's something of interest to people. I tried in writing it not to get too caught up in all the, you know, Byzantine elaborate details, but it's a very fascinating story, I think, especially for someone with a legal background to go through it and see the different moves and even through the appeals, how this thing played out. Because, you know, the one of the, and I, just one other thing that's not in the book, I should probably add. I didn't even put this in the book. A lot of things I kind of, you know, left out that I didn't want to get too detailed in some cases to where it just killed the reader's brain off. But I will tell you the truth of the matter. The prosecuting attorney, Thomas Shriver, his dad was from a War Trace area in Middle Tennessee, not too far from where my dad's from. But he was up for election. He was up for re-election as a DA that year. And, you know, so this was a very public trial. It was very, the investigation, he was very involved in the investigation. You know, what were his motivations? Again, I mean, no offense to his family, but to me, that seems like a fair question. You know, the whole thing just kind of played out in a very fascinating way. And the attorney who was representing John Brown was having tremendous issues with cocaine at the time. The one day of the trial was delayed because he was in the hospital with his blood pressure through the roof, all kind of craziness. A lot of it, subsequent to this trial, a lot of his things where he was involved were brought under great scrutiny, the cases he was involved in. And I know this because my aunt's husband started working for the DA at that time. And Arnold Peebles is his name, the man who I was talking about had the cocaine issues and other addictive issues with addiction. But he was no longer a part of the bar, and there are all these issues. But somehow when you came back to the String Bean trial, that one never, it didn't matter what anybody brought up in the way sort of real objections. They just didn't get looked at. They just didn't. So, you know, what are the motivations there? I don't know all of them, and it would not be appropriate for me to say anything for certain, but I think there are a lot of interesting questions there that if somebody wanted to pursue them, you might find some very interesting answers. You might not. I really don't know. But that was my experience of writing about that.
Well, thank you very much, Taylor. And I didn't say this, but like, just to be really clear, all devoted listeners, the book is really good and you should really read it. And it's really solid start to finish, every page, lots going on. And if you take any kind of time to dip through the things like the citations, you will get some little glimpse of the amount of work and thought that went into this. It's really pretty clearly a labor of love, and it's doing well. it seems. Congratulations, Taylor.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I appreciate very much this time. It's a, you know, Robert and Joe, it's an honor to meet y'all. I appreciate very much this opportunity and this getting to spend this time with you. And,
well, thank you. Thank you for delving into some of these questions and bringing up the South of my youth. Saturday afternoons watching good old hillbilly music.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, sir.
Well, thanks again to Taylor Haygood for joining us today. To learn more about Taylor and his projects and the book, please visit our website for more information and links. Just a special note that the banjo piece heard during the podcast was played by Taylor on the banjo he made. And if you stick around to the end, we have two more pieces that Taylor played on the banjo and sang for us. We'd love to hear from you and get your ideas and your feedback. And if you'd like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us on the contact link on our website. News from the Peak is a project of Grace Peak Strategies and is produced by Maureen Life, David Ram, Robert Riddle, and me. You can learn more about us at gracepeakstrategies.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Grace Peak, and we're easy to find on Facebook and LinkedIn as well. This was News from the Peak. I'm Joe Mamlin. Thanks for joining us.
I was in fact, two Scandinavian countries in the space of a month, Sweden and Minnesota.
I'm not going to pretend that there's some child support connection or anything.
I can even sing the Martha White Self-Rising Flower jingle for you if you need me to.
Yeah, I do.
I think need is the right word, Robert.
If it didn't have a steel guitar, they didn't want to listen to it. And it was hillbilly music. It wasn't country music.
You know something? Hello, everybody. Nice to meet you all. I hope everybody's doing well. Did this start at 11, actually? For some reason, I had this written down in my calendar as noon, and I am deeply apologizing for that. I'm very sorry. I hope forgiveness for this terrible oversight on my part.
Well, I hope it's the worst thing that happens to me today.
Yeah, you don't have to be worried. We won't be calling you mama and telling her you that Taylor showed up late again.
And as always, the public policy takeaway here is you should not commit murder. Just so it's clear, there is a strong public policy message here. Grace Peak, firmly against murder. Everyone knows that.
Yes. I absolutely want to make sure I'm supporting this. Oh, Joe, you're a good man. You're a good man. Kitchen upstairs, downstairs, down in the kitchen. Upstairs, downstairs, down in the kitchen. Hey, Uncle Bill is a rare in the kitchen. Yes, sir. Popcorn, cold corn, bring along a dimension. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a dimension. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a dimension. Farewell, Uncle Bill, see you in the morning. Yes, sir.
Preachers are coming and the children are crying. Preachers are coming and the children are crying. Preachers are coming and the children are crying. Chickens are running and the toads flying. Yes, sir. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a dimmy john. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a dimmy john. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a dimmy john. Farewell, Uncle, we'll see you in the morning. Yes, sir. Folks are sleeping. Come on down to the barnyard. Let's have some little banjo picking.
My mind is too merry and never